offering my most loving pranams and Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and it is my pleasure to meet you all again this week. But like we do every Thursday, I'm not coming to you live from our studios in Prashanthi Nilayam. This is a pre-recorded program. But nevertheless, it is a fresh episode of the Gita series. And most of you must be already aware that we are not doing any live programs as of now. Those of you who are very concerned about us, who've been sending messages to the various team members and to our official email IDs and WhatsApp number, let me assure you, all of us are very well. We are doing really good by Swami's grace. Swami is taking very good care of each one of us. But as a precautionary measure, we are reducing some of our activities, and especially in these times, being in a close space that is air-conditioned, like our studios are, is not the best idea. And that's why we are trying not to do group recordings. We're trying not to have panel discussions. And that's one more reason why I'm not meeting you along with Arvind as part of Afternoon Satsang 2. But nevertheless, this episode that you're listening to is a fresh episode, and also it is a continuation of where we left off a couple of weeks back, I think, which was on the 6th of August, if I'm not wrong. So I'm going to continue from there. As always, we'll begin with a short summary of what I completed last time, and I should honestly say that it's not going to be a short summary, because it's going to be a little elaborate summary, because some points which Swami made in Gita Vaini with reference to some of the shlokas that we covered last time, I would like to dwell a little more deep into them. Last time when I concluded, I left you hanging by saying that I'm going to tell you a story. Yes, that story is also going to be part of the summary today, but not right away. It's going to come later. But there are some very, very important points that Swami speaks about in the context that we are discussing, and I thought it is appropriate to do that now. So because of that, I think there will be more talking today before I play the shloka that is lined up for today. And I'm guessing that we will not be able to do more than one shloka. But we'll take it as it comes, and we'll see how it pans out. The last time we did three shlokas, shloka number 6, 7 and 8. In the 6th shloka, after having spoken about the two prakritis, I hope all of you still recall what are those things. It suddenly feels like it's been a very long time. Krishna spoke about the two prakritis, para prakriti, apara prakriti, and he spoke of how that is how creation came to be. So in the 6th shloka, Krishna clearly states that all things have their source only in these two prakritis. And the two prakritis are in turn from the Lord himself, right? And we discussed this with a few analogies. Even before I gave you those analogies, I spoke of how all analogies are limited in their scope. One of the analogies is when a child is born. When a child is born from a mother, even as the child is born, motherhood is also born along with the child. The new entity is created in the form of the child, but this existing entity now gets a new form or a new name. And that is how we spoke of para prakriti being born along with apara prakriti. But this analogy only tells half the story, because Krishna says he is not only the source, but he is also the end. So this separation, as we spoke about last time, what starts from a source and then returns to the same source, and for a very brief period in eternity when there is separation, it only means that that separation is also a form of illusion. But then this gives rise to another question, and a very valid one. The same Lord is para and apara prakriti, the Lord and the world. Why can't we then go after the world? Why can't we enjoy it? Why are we often told, why do the scriptures tell us, why do the gurus and masters tell us that we should not go after the world and we should seek God? But the idea is, though both have the same source, choosing one binds, choosing another frees. If the vyakti or individual goes after the world, that is the apara prakriti, then the vyaktitva or individuality will be further strengthened. But if the vyakti turns to God, then that vyaktitva gets sublimated and one will be able to see this truth that Krishna is explaining. Since this whole thing is an illusion, nothing is actually separated. It is all in perception. And that perception of separation gets strengthened when one goes after the world. And that perception of separation, that illusion, that maya gets dissolved when one goes after para prakriti. In the Gita Vahini, Swami explains this as follows, and I quote it as Swami says there. Swami says, seen superficially with the gross vision, the universe might appear as many, but that is wrong. There is no many at all. The yearning of the inner consciousness or antakarna is towards the one. That is the real vision. When inner vision is saturated with wisdom, creation will be seen as Brahman and as nothing else. Therefore, the inner consciousness must be educated to interest itself only in wisdom. Swami explains this illusion of one from many, right? The very beautiful explanation that Swami gives there. The inner craving is always towards recognizing that one, and to give a direction to that, to give impetus to that craving is what Krishna is speaking about here. And Swami goes on to explain this, the many from one, when one doesn't undergo any change at all, but there is the many, and he does that through a very simple and classic analogy in this part of Gita Vahini. I'll probably paraphrase it a little. I'm not going to read it verbatim. Swami says, and very beautifully and very clearly Swami writes, he says, we walk in the thick dusk of evening when things are seen rather dimly. A rope lies there on the path. Each one who sees it has their own idea of what it is, although it is really just a length of rope. One steps across it, taking it to be a garland. Another takes it to be a mark made by running water and treads on it. A third person imagines it to be a creeper plucked from off a tree and fallen on the path. Some others are scared that it is a snake, isn't it? Similarly, the one highest Brahman, without any change or transformation affecting it, being all the time it and it only, manifests as the world of manifold names and forms. The cause of all this seeming is the dusk of delusion or maya. The rope might appear as many things. It might provoke various feelings and reactions on various people. It has become the basis for variety that way, but it never changes into many. It is ever one. The rope is ever the rope. It does not become a garland or a streak of water or a creeper or a snake. End of quote. We've made references to this analogy of the rope in half darkness and half light. It's a classic example and analogy from Vedanta. But the same analogy, Swami very beautifully plays about it a little bit more and says that the rope is just the rope. There are different people who come and perceive it in different ways. So the idea is that there is no separation at all. The separation itself is a play of maya. And this separation creates para and apara prakriti. Right? So the idea is to look beyond this maya and see the one where there appears the many. Look beyond multiplicity and see unity. And for that, one must seek the para and not be lost in the apara. Because later in this chapter, Krishna will speak a little more on this theme about maya and how some people go after maya and get lost and some people transcend it. But that is a little much later in the chapter itself. Coming back to the verses that we covered last time, this was the sixth verse that I spoke about and passages from Gita Vahini related to that. In the seventh verse, Krishna speaks or makes two important points. and these points reiterate what we had discussed. One, he states clearly that there is no other divinity. There is no Lord who is more supreme who has created the two Prakritis. Right? Krishna says, I am the supreme, and then states, Mayi sarvamidam protam sutre manigana iva. All this is strung on me like pearls on a string. So those are the two points that Krishna makes in the seventh verse. The significance of this particular verse is, you know, when you say that everything that is seen has come from para prakriti and apara prakriti, is there somebody who has created these two? Is there somebody who is more supreme? Right? Krishna states, no, what I am referring to as para prakriti is actually the supreme. It is me. And as I was saying, it is not the creation of the two. It is actually creation of the one which gives the original also a different identity. When the child is born, the same woman is now called mother. So in that sense, so that is the significance of the first line of the seventh chapter. I am sorry. The first line of the seventh verse of the seventh chapter. And in the second one, as I just said, Krishna says, all this that is seen is strung on me like pearls on a string. Again, a very beautiful analogy. There are two ways of looking at this and understanding this. One, the Lord is that thread that runs through all beings in the universe that is seen. The other way of looking at it is, the Lord is the thread which is the life that holds together all these elements which forms each one of these bodies. Our body is made of the five elements, so many atoms, and if you were to go into the science, so many elements, so many cells get together to make this, right? What holds all of these particles together and we're able to identify someone as a person? You could also imagine the analogy in that context that the life that holds together these particles and forms a person, Krishna says, I am that thread. Either way, this is the concept of the Adhara, the unseen Adhara, and the seen Adheya. Adhara means foundation, and Adheya is that which is on this foundation. So when you see a garland or a necklace of pearls, like what Krishna is referring to here, you may not be able to see the string, but the very fact that the garland exists, that itself is the proof of the string. And once you know this, right, let us say at some point in our childhood, we did not know that there is a string behind the pearl necklace. At some point, we experience it, right? And once we have experienced it, you don't have to see it at all. It never has to see your eye. The moment you see a garland, the very fact that there is a garland, the very fact there is a pearl necklace, you know that there is a string behind. So when I see a pearl necklace, I know there is a string. Swami says in the Gita Vahini, for the unseen, there is an unseen basis. To grasp the unseen, the best means is inquiry, and the best proof is experience. For those who have experienced, no description is required. So beautifully Swami puts it there, right? The moment you experience that unseen string in some form, right? As a child, you might have pulled apart a garland or something like that, and you'd have seen that string. The moment you have that experience of the unseen being the basis of the seen, Swami says that experience, once acquired, no description is required, and you will never forget this fact that there is an Adhara, an unseen Adhara behind the seen Adhya. From the 8th shloka, Krishna gives a series of examples and also goes on to mention a few elements and entities and talks about those attributes that make them what they are, right? Or what are those unique actor qualities in that element, or, what distinguishes or makes them distinct. That quality, Krishna says, I am that quality. And he goes on to say that, know that I am present in these elements as these. This could be either a fundamental quality or a defining quality, or in some examples, you'll find that it is also the best version or the best form of that particular entity. The shloka that we will see today also has few such examples. We'll come to that a little later. In the 8th shloka, what does Krishna say? He begins by saying, I am taste or rasa in water. I am effulgence or prabha in the sun and the moon. I am the om, the pranava in the Vedas. I am the sound in space. I am paurusham or vitality or heroism in men. We had discussed the significance of Krishna saying, I am taste in water and I am sound in akasha. Because these qualities of sound and taste, these are the ones that define these subtle elements or tanmatra akasha and tanmatra apa. Few more elements will be spoken about in the shloka that we're going to see today also. But that is the significance of Krishna saying, I am taste in water, I am sound in akasha, or khe, as he tells in this particular shloka. When Krishna says in the next description that he gives here, paurusham nrishu, I am paurusha in man. Paurusha is actually the quality of purusha. Purusha means man. So paurusha means manliness, right? So it is often interpreted as, I am manliness in man. I don't think it would be completely wrong, because going by whatever Krishna is saying, that fits in there, right? I am manliness in man. But the explanation that Swami gives, paurusham, is very profound in Gita Vahini, and I think we should make a reference to that. So Swami in the Gita Vahini states that this paurusham that Krishna is speaking about is the vitality and adventurousness that leads an individual to break free from Maya. As I said, we'll be speaking about this a little later too, because Krishna speaks about courage and speaks about, again, the spirit of adventurousness later. But what Swami says here is very important. We all are sadhakas. We are on the spiritual path, right? And there are past vasanas, past karmas, past nature and tendencies, and all of these are pulling us down, right? There is a feeling that, oh, I'm never going to be able to overcome these. This is what I am, and this is what I'm going to always be. But when you take to a spiritual path, Swami says it all starts with a strong sense of confidence and adventurism that, no, I can break these shackles and I can move forward. Swami refers to that attitude as paurusham, right? And we've been seeing that in some of the shlokas that we went through. So much importance is given to that adventurousness. Dhira, right? The person who finally turns inward from this worldly life is referred to as a dhira. A very adventurous person finally who looks for something beyond what the world can offer. And that is referred to as paurusham by Krishna, is what Swami says. So when he says paurusham rishu, among the many men and women who are lost in worldliness, a few have the spark to turn to spirituality and they have the will and confidence to move forward. Krishna says, I am that attitude, right? It's a very profound explanation that Swami gives about this particular statement that Krishna makes. And I think we did miss this out when we did the shloka, and that's why I thought, well, I'll pick out some of these explanations from Gita Vahini and present it to you today. Another very important point that Krishna makes in that shloka is, pranavaha sarva vedeshu. I am pranava or om in the Vedas. So this was the point where we concluded last time. Of course, I spoke a little about pranava, the importance of pranava, and especially this statement, I am pranava in the sarva, in all the Vedas. I gave you that example of what Adi Shankara says as the most important Upanishad, which is the Mandukya Upanishad. And the reason that he says Mandukya is most important is because it praises the pranava. But truly speaking, there are there are many, many Upanishads, many spiritual texts that speak about the importance of pranava, and I don't think it is ever possible to give a comprehensive description of what pranava stands for in the course of this program, or even if I were to do it as a dedicated entire program on pranava or pranava upasana, the worship of this primordial sound. But nevertheless, I think it's very important. The statement which Krishna is making is very profound. Pranava is very, very profound. Whoever is interested in the Upanishads, whoever is interested in Vedanta, will have to understand the importance that this single alphabet or single syllable word has in Vedantic context. So Om or Pranava is, even in the scriptures, described as one of the most important sounds. And as I was saying the last time, Krishna refers to this later in one of the chapters, I think the 10th chapter or something, where he says it is Ekaksharam Brahma, the one letter that represents Brahman. Swami explains how all sounds come from this one sound. And underlying all sounds, the pranava continues to sound and vibrate and reverberate, right? I will read out one particular passage from Gita Vaini again. It's quite clear in itself, but I will try and explain it a little after that also. But pay attention to this, because it's any number of times Swami has spoken about pranava, and I was just trying to read up a little. It is impossible to, in a short period of time, cover everything that Swami has spoken about it. Forget about covering it. Even for reading it, it's not possible for me. But a few things that Swami says, we will discuss about it, especially in this passage where Swami speaks, is the essence of what we refer to as pranava. Swami says, and I will read out that passage, I quote, "There is one matter that you have to take into consideration here, a matter that is within the daily experience of all, from the pundit to the ignoramus. Letters. In Telugu, there are 52 letters. In English, there are 26. If you were to pile up the entire library output in Telugu or English, the pile would rise mountain high. Even then, it is all composed of the same 52 Telugu letters or 26 English alphabets. Not a single letter more. Similarly, in the human body, there are 6 nerve centers, all in the form of lotus flowers. All six lotus forms have one letter or sound attached to each petal. Like the reeds in the harmonium, when the petals are moved, each one emanates a distinct sound. Those who follow this statement intelligently may get a doubt. If the petals are said to move, who or what is moving them? Yes, the force that moves them is the primeval unstruck sound, the anahata dhvani, which emanates without effort, regardless of conscious will. That is Om. Like beads in the string, all letters and the sounds that are present are strung on this Om. That is the meaning of the statement that He is the Om of the Vedas. Krishna's teaching is that you should merge your mind in Om, which is the universal basis." End of quote. So that is the passage from Gita Vaini where Swami speaks about the importance of Om. And Swami refers to a very beautiful and profound name for pranava, the Anahata Dhvani. It is also called Anahata Nada. Anahata Dhvani can be translated in a sense as the unstruck chord. Swami himself said the primeval unstruck sound, or the sound that is not created by striking some things or creating some movement. This is one of the very, very deep concepts in yoga. How everything comes forth from this pranava. And Swami gives this very beautiful example of a harmonium, right? Most of us are familiar with that instrument, or any instrument that involves keys and a reed instrument, if I could put it that way. When we press different keys of the harmonium, different sounds are heard. But the basis of all those sounds, however, maybe the variety, I'm not a musician, so I don't know exactly how many sounds can be produced through a harmonium and the various combinations. There can be any number, it's a huge number, I'm sure. But all those sounds emanate or have their basis in the air that is pumped into the harmonium, right? Same is the case with the flute also, right? All kinds of sounds can be created in that flute. But everything is created only because of that breath which is blown into that instrument. Because we concentrate on the sounds, the various sounds and chords and notes, we do not focus on that basis of that sound. And this anahata dhvani is the basis of all those sounds. And since it is the basis of all the sounds, it is also the basis of all mantras, the Vedas, speech. And if you really look into it, it is also the basis for all matter. Because everything is a form of vibration. Everything is formed from this. In quantum chemistry, we speak of this as the zero state energy, right? Or zero energy state, where nothing is moving and nothing is active, but still there is an energy, right? And they say that everything manifested from that energy in different permutations and combinations, right? So that is referred to as anahata dhvani, the unstruck sound or uncreated sound, which is the pranava. And one of the ways you can actually sense this is a very simple thing, and I'm sure all of us as children would have done it. Swami would give the example, if you take a conch and you put it to your ear, the sound that you hear in the conch is pranava. Or even more simpler than that is the different types of pranayamas that is taught. One of the pranayamas is referred to as the Brahmari pranayama, right? Where you close both your ears with your thumbs and then you close your eyes with your pointer finger and then your nose. And then I'm sure some of you must be aware of that. Of course, in the Brahmari pranayama, you create the sound of a humming of a bee. But if you just close your ears with your thumbs and just listen to that sound, Swami says you hear a sound, and that is referred to as anahata, which is already in your body. There is nothing that is creating that sound. It is not coming from outside. It is coming from within, and from within it is coming in spite of nothing creating that sound. Or one way you can mildly experience it, This is one way you can do that. And in yogic practices, they say that as you advance in yoga, you will begin to listen to the sound even without having to plug your ears and, you know, concentrate on this. And that's the essence of some of the yogic practices. In fact, Swami has spoken about some of these things in Prashnottara Vahini. He speaks about the 10 sounds. That are heard during the process of meditation, and he goes on to speak about all of them. Definitely, we will not go into all of that. It is beyond the scope of this program. It is beyond my scope of understanding at this moment. So I will not try to explain to you what I've not managed to understand myself completely. But you get the concept of the importance of pranava, right? The pranava is not even a sound. It is a pre-sound. What we chant as Om or Omkara, you could say it is an audible representation of pranava. But real pranava, as Swami said, is unmanifest sound, anahata dhwani. In fact, there is another very beautiful concept where they speak about how sound is created, or more specifically, how speech is created, how we express ourselves through speech, and this can be extended even to the different forms of communication, writing, and so on. So they say that there are four stages in which you communicate or you express yourself. The four stages are referred to as para, pashyanti, madhyama, and vaikhari. The fourth stage, or vaikhari, is the expression. When I speak something, I have given sound to a thought, right? That is what we refer to as speaking. So I have expressed that thought in a manner that you can hear and you can understand. But before I express that, there are three stages: para, pashyanti, and madhyama. Again, I will not go into very deep details about these things. It's a very profound concept, and it'll take a lot more reading from my part before I will be able to explain this better. But you can get a drift of it. I'll try to put it as simple as possible as I've tried to understand it myself. So when I am trying to speak, first there is a thought. Then I verbalize that thought in the form of speech in my mind. I've not yet spoken it, but I verbalize it in my mind. And then I speak it. Isn't it? That's what happens to us all the time. There is a reaction in the mind, or there is a desire or a craving to say something, or an impulse to express something. And then I verbalize it in my mind, and then I express it. Because we have all become pretty much experts in verbalizing in the mind and speaking. And as Swami would always say, that is the problem with most of us. There is no gap between thinking and speaking. We don't think before we speak. So we don't realize that there are three stages to this. But this is what happens every time we express a thought. There is a thought. The thought gets verbalized in speech in the mind, and then it is expressed as speech when we speak. So that thought is referred to as pashyanti stage, the mental verbalization. The thought occurring is referred to as pashyanti stage. The mental verbalization is referred to as madhyama. And madhyama also means the middle stage. And the third is the expression, which is vaikhari. Now this pashyanti stage is very interesting. The thought, the word pashyanti itself means to see, right? So this pashyanti state is quite interesting, where the words are not even being articulated within your mind, but it is referred to as pashyanti, which means the thoughts can actually be seen. When we talk about the Vedas, we often say the Vedas are apaurusheya. They are not being created by a human intellect, but they have been received. We say that the great sages, and we refer to the sages as mantra drashtas or mantra drashtaras, those who have been able to see mantras, right? They did not hear the mantras, they saw the mantras, right? So in a very pure state of mind, these mantra drashtaras, they were able to quote unquote see sounds. And at this stage, it is said that language doesn't matter. Right? Language matters only when I am verbalizing. Even in thinking, there is language, right? Before we speak. That's why many of us struggle to speak in different languages if you're not used to that. Because your thinking also happens in a certain language. And if you have to, those of us who are accustomed to giving talks in a certain language, when asked to speak in a different language, we form our thoughts in English and then we translate it into the language we are speaking in. And that's why that there is a little bit of struggle, right? Because even thinking has a language. But the thought stage, before it has been verbalized in the mind, that state does not even have a language. So in the pashyanti phase, one can see the thoughts even before they are expressed in the form of a language. And needless to say, we have experienced this with Swami, isn't it? There's no surprise in that. He's beyond all of these stages. So in this stage, you are able to see each other's thoughts even before they are expressed. And many, many times we have had experiences with Swami like that, where you would not be aware of your own thoughts, or you would not have spoken about it to your own mind, but Swami would sense thoughts such as that. But even beyond the Pashyanti stage is the stage called Para. Again, the word itself is not new to us. Para means beyond. So they've just given it the name beyond. So Para is the stage which is purely unmanifest, even before the thought has been manifested. And this stage is Pranava, the sound beyond all sounds, the sound behind all sounds. So the Vedas come from the Para, and in the Pashyanti stage, they are conceived by the mantra drashtas, the sages who saw these mantras, and then they pass it on to us. Right? So when Krishna says Pranavaha Sarva Vedeshu, he is referring to this state. I am the Para aspect of sound. I am the Pranava. Right? It's a very loaded statement, that one statement that Krishna makes. In the Vedas, I am Pranava, because, you know, he's beyond even what the Vedas describe. That is the essence of that. This concentrating on the Pranava is one of the ways of concentrating on the Brahman principle itself. And that is why Vedanta speaks so highly of Pranava, gives so much importance to Pranavopasana, as it is said. So this concentrating on Pranava itself is a means by which one can concentrate on Brahman. And in the passage following the passage that I read out some time ago, where Swami spoke about the harmonium and the different sounds that are created by Pranava, Swami explains this in Gita Vaini, and I'll just read out that passage. Swami says, and I quote, "The mind has an innate tendency to merge in whatever it contacts. It craves this, so it is ever agitated and restless. But by constant practice and training, it can be directed towards Om and taught to merge with it. It is also naturally drawn towards the sound. That is why it is compared to a serpent. The serpent has two crude qualities: its crooked gait and its tendency to bite all that comes in its way. These two are also the characteristics of people. People also seek to hold and possess all that they set their eyes on. They also move crookedly. But the serpent has one praiseworthy trait. However poisonous and deadly its nature may be, when the strains of the charmer's music are played, it spreads its hood and merges itself in the sweetness of that sound, forgetting everything else. Similarly, through practice, people can merge themselves in the bliss of Om. This close attention to sound or Shabda is a principal way to realize the highest Atma, who is the Om of the Vedas. He is not other than sound." End of quote. So very beautifully, Swami says the underlying sound or the underlying principle of everything is Om. And when you learn this art of concentrating on this Om, you are actually transcending names and forms. In fact, if you, those of you interested can go and read that particular chapter. I think it is the 12th or the 13th chapter of the Gita Vaini, where Swami speaks about this. Swami also speaks about how names and forms are also superimposed on this Pranava. Now, generally speaking, what is very scarce is considered very precious. Why is gold and diamonds and some of these precious metals precious? because there is only a limited reserve and it is not easy to find them. And same is the case when it comes to, say, a rare fruit or a herb or a flower or a rare medicine, right? But when we talk about pranava, pranava is a sound which is most ubiquitous, but at the same time, it is most precious. It underlies all sounds. As I was saying, we don't even have to go anywhere. Swami explains in one of his discourses, it's, you know, you go to the river front, the water that is gushing, that sound is pranava. The waterfall, that sound is pranava. If there's a dhobi who's washing clothes and hitting the clothes on the rock, that sound is pranava. So everything Swami says is only a modification of this pranava. And if you just close your ears with your thumbs, you can listen to pranava. How can something that is so freely available be so precious? And it was in this context that I wanted to tell a story last time, which I missed out. So I'll complete it now. So there is this story of a sadhaka who goes to a guru. And he has a very simple prayer that he places in front of the guru. He says, I want the most precious of mantras, a mantra which is the key to all the wealth of the world. So this is the proposal he is placing in front of the guru. Give me mantra upadesha, but give me the most precious of mantras, the mantra that can open the doors to all treasures of the world. So the guru smiles and he says, definitely I will give you, but you will have to do some sadhana before that. You know, I cannot simply give you that mantra because after all, it is the most precious mantra. So he says, you have to stay in my ashram. You will have to, do the duties that are assigned to you. You should do some simple sadhana, meditation and sandhya vandanam and all of that. And when I find you worthy, I will give you the most precious mantra. So then the disciple joins the ashram. And for many years, he follows all the stipulated duties that are given to him. And nothing seems to be happening. The guru doesn't seem to be in any mood of giving him the mantra. So at one point, he goes to the guru and says, Master, you promised to give me that most precious mantra. It's been so many years. I have followed whatever you've told me to. Why don't you give it to me? So the guru smiles at him and says, yes, I think it's time now. I will give you the most precious mantra. So he says, go and have a bath in the river and come and I'll give you the mantra. So the boy goes, has a bath, comes back, and the guru whispers in his ears the mantra, Om. The disciple is thrilled. He says, the master has given me a mantra and it's the most precious mantra. So then he goes about his work. So one of his works is probably he has to go and get some material from the market or get some firewood or something. So when he goes, at each stage, he realizes different people using the same mantra Om for different things. He sees that a beggar is asking Om Bhavati Bhikshan Dehi. And the lady who is offering the alms comes and says Om and gives it. Then he sees that there is a marriage ceremony which is happening. The marriage ceremony's mantra is begin by that person chanting Om. He goes a little further. There is a person who has been given Gayatri Mantra Upadesha. Upanayanam is being performed. And there the master is telling Om and chanting the Gayatri Mantra. He goes a little further. He sees a funeral and there they chanting mantras. And before chanting the mantras, they are chanting Om. So he says that, oh my God, my guru has cheated me. He has given me the most ordinary of mantras because everyone seems to be using it. It seems to be all over the place. How can this be the most precious of mantras? So he goes back to his guru and he says, Master, you have deceived me. What you have given me is not the most precious of all mantras. And the master smiles at him and he says, why do you say so? And then he explains that I went to the ceremony and there they chanted the mantra, the Upanayanam they chanted the mantra. At their funeral, they chanted the mantra. And he said, how can this be the most precious? So the master says, okay, I will give you the most precious mantra now. But before that, you have to do one final task for me. So the disciple is happy. He says, okay, finally I got my master. And now he's prepared to give me the actual mantra. So the master goes inside the ashram and he brings out what appears to be a crystal ball, right? Just like a huge translucent rock. And he gives it to the disciple and he tells him, now you go into the market and try to sell this rock. And he says, don't sell the rock, just try to sell the rock and you come back to me and tell me what is the best deal that you get for this rock. Who's ready to prepare, who's prepared to pay maximum for this rock. So he takes the rock and he says, what is the funda behind this and why does the master want me to sell a rock when I'm after all a spiritual person asking for the greatest of spiritual mantras? So he goes in search of somebody who will be prepared to buy the rock. So he goes into the marketplace. The first thing he sees is a stall where there is a man who's selling vegetables. So he goes up to him and he says, in return for this rock, how much will you give, or how much material will you give in return for this? Because those are the times when they must have been barter system also. So the man looks at the rock, he takes it in his hand, and he picks up the stone that he has kept aside, meant for weighing out vegetables, right? Those are times when they were probably not standard measures. So he takes that rock, and he takes this rock that the disciple has brought, and he says, more or less these two are the same weight, so I could probably use this to measure out vegetables. You can take any one or two of these vegetables that you want. And the disciple says, is that all the worth of this rock? The man says, yes. After all, it is going to be used only for this. How much more can I give for that? So he takes the rock from that vegetable vendor, and he goes to another provision shop, and again he asks the same question. And that man shouts at him, because it's a little bigger shop, he doesn't even use rocks. So he looks at him and says, see, you're a Brahmin, you want some food, you tell me, I will give you free. Don't waste my time bringing all these things and don't try to do business with something which is so worthless. And literally he throws the rock back at him. So then he goes to another place where somebody is selling silk. And again that man says that, you know, it looks nice, maybe my child would like to play with it, so I could probably give you a few annas or something for that, and that's all it is worth. So different people have different reactions, and finally he goes into a shop where jewels are being sold. There's a man who trades in precious gems and gold. He goes to him and he says, how much is this rock? The man takes this rock in his hand and he asks, where did you get this from? The disciple says, what does it matter to you? Just tell me, what is the cost of this rock? How much will you be prepared to give? And the man returns that rock and says, I will not be able to give you anything for this. So the disciple says, do you also say that it is worthless? The jeweler says, I'm not saying it is worthless. I am saying I am not worth it. He says, even if I were to give you all the gold in my shop, it will not be the appropriate payment for this rock. And he says, even if you go to the biggest of cities, I don't think there will be any jeweler who will be able to give you the appropriate price for this rock. It's a very, very, very precious stone. Some great king must have given it as a gift to your master and he must have given it to you. But I'm sorry, I will not be able to buy this. I do not have the means to buy this rock from you. So the disciple is very surprised and he goes back to his master and he reports the whole thing as it happened. And then the master says, even pranava is like that. It is available to everyone. Everyone uses it. But not all know the preciousness of this mantra. So that is why this is so very profound, the pranava mantra. I am sure all of us chant this mantra so many times without our knowledge, right? Merely sitting through a bhajan session, there are so many times we chant this alphabet om. But how many of us really know how profound this is? And as that story goes, he asks for the mantra which will unlock the treasures to the entire world, right? In fact, in the conversation between Nachiketa and Yama, I made a reference to it even before. One of the questions that Nachiketa asks is that very profoundly worded question. Nachiketa looks at Yama and asks, anyatra dharmat, anyatra adharmat, anyatra asmat kritakritat. Different or beyond virtue, different from vice, different from this cause and effect. Anyatra bhutach bhavyach yat tat pashyasi tadvada. And different from past and different from future. He says, what is beyond virtue and beyond vice and beyond cause and effect and beyond past and present? Tatvada. Tat pashyasi tatvada. He said, tell me, O Yama, that which you see is beyond all this. And in reply to that, Yama says, Sarve Veda Yad Padam Amananti, which all the Vedas with one voice propound. Tapamsi Sarvani Cha Yad Vadanti, which all the austerities speak of. Yadi Chinto Brahmacharyam Charanti Tat. Yad Ichanto Brahmacharyam Charanti Tat. Wishing for what people practice Brahmacharya. Te Padam Sangrahena Bravim Om Iti Etat. That word I will tell you briefly, and that word is Om. Etat Evaksharam Brahma. This letter indeed is the Brahman. Etat Evaksharam Param. This letter indeed is the Supreme. Etat Evaksharam Nyatva. He who knows this word, Yo Yadichati Tasyatat. He obtains whatever he desires for. So these are the words of Lord Yama to Nachiketa. He says, what is that one mantra which opens the treasures to all worlds? He says, it is this. Om Iti Ekaksharam. This one-syllabled word, Om. I think even in the Gita, there's going to be a later portion where Krishna speaks about Om. We will again dwell into the importance of Om. It's a very sacred and profound concept in Sanatana Dharma. And that's why I spent a lot of time on this. I'm really sorry about that. But it was an opportunity for us to understand. And elsewhere in Swami's discourses, in one of the Samukos discourses, Swami says that everybody chants Om. If you don't understand anything about the Om Pranava Mantra and you still chant Om, Swami says you'll get physical benefits. If you chant understanding little what is the essence of Om, Swami says you will get spiritual and mental and subtle benefits. But the one who understands completely what is Om and chants it just as sadhana, without having any expectations, Swami says he attains the ultimate. So the same pranava, it is so powerful, and that's why I thought I'll take a few minutes and dwell on that. We're pretty much close to the end of this week's episode, but nevertheless, I think I'll just play out the next shloka. Whatever little time possible, we'll dwell on that, and then we'll take it forward from there next week. So I'll play the ninth shloka in the seventh chapter, which is a continuation of the similar examples that Krishna has been giving in the eighth. We'll listen to that, and with that, we'll conclude.
Punyo gandhah prithivyancha tejaschasni vibhavasau jivanam sarvabhuteshu tapaschami tapasvishu.
I am the pure smell in the earth. I am the brilliance in the fire. I am the life principle in all beings. And the austerity in ascetics. So Krishna continues his beautiful description of how he is present as various aspects and also as the essence of all things. He had mentioned two elements in the previous shloka, rasaha aham apsu, in water I am the taste, shabdaha ke, in ether I am sound. Here he mentions two more elements. And what we saw in the previous shloka also holds good here. That is, when these tanmatras were created, along with them, the corresponding sense or quality was also created. So he says here first, cha and prithivyam, in the earth, punyaha gandaha, I am sweet fragrance. As I was telling the last time, the special attribute that is born with the element of earth is smell. And Krishna specifically says, punyaha gandaha, sweet smell. I'll come to what this could possibly mean. The other element that Krishna mentions here is fire. He says, vibhavasau cha, and in fire, tejaha asmi, I am brilliance. Both these qualities that Krishna is mentioning, punyagandha, that is pleasant smell, and tejas or brilliance, can be seen in two ways. One, as I said, they are the quality associated with that element. Smell is born with earth and sight with fire. But the reason Krishna uses pleasant smell and brilliance is also a very poetic way of saying, I feel the idea that is being conveyed here, I feel, is sense me in all that is pleasant and awe-inspiring. Whenever you have an experience that is pleasant and uplifting and awe-inspiring, sense my presence there. When you walk in the woods or you walk around in the garden, there's always a pleasant smell, right? It is not too strong, not too overpowering, but very refreshing and elevating. Where do the plants and flowers get their smell from, their fragrance from? It is from earth. Similarly, Petrika, the sweet smell of the first rain, as they say, when there's a gentle shower after long spells of dryness. We all have experienced that smell. It's a very unique fragrance. It's not similar to any other pleasant fragrance that we have had, but it's very unique, but it really lifts you up. You know, you feel so refreshed when that smell comes. That is the smell of earth. So next time when you experience those fragrances, when we experience these pleasant experiences, can we think of it as Swami's presence? Similarly, Swami says the brilliance of fire. Well, for us it is quite easy to associate the flame and think of Swami, because thanks to the flame red orange robe that Swami always wore. But when Krishna says tejas, it refers to the life-giving aspect in fire as well. Both the light and the warmth. And Krishna says, I am that tejas. Fire wouldn't be fire if divinity does not pervade it. Right? So these two descriptions are also very poetic, a very poetic way of saying that when you see something beautiful, when you experience something pleasant, when you're awed by something, when you're thrilled by a magnificent sight, think of God. Because all that is God, all that is experienced as pleasantness is verily God. As some commentators point out, at this point, had Arjuna asked a question, when Krishna says, Punya Gandha, I am the Punya Gandha, I am the pleasant smell, had Arjuna asked the question, O Krishna, who is the unpleasant smell then? If you are the pleasant smell, who is the unpleasant smell? Or who is the destructive power in fire if you are the tejas? What do you think Krishna would have answered in reply? He would have said, well, that is also me. Though that is the idea that the pleasant and the unpleasant, the happiness and the sad, everything is same. You know, that is the samadrishti that we've been talking about, and we've been saying that that is what needs to be reached. But that's what Krishna spoke about in the past few chapters too. But the means to that is through this effort to look for God. And look for God in, you know, that is a way by which you are pursuing para-prakriti in a para-prakriti. Whatever is pleasant, can it remind you of God? Whatever is awe-inspiring, can it remind you of God? And for that, Krishna is giving this method. Can we all make this a habit? Every time we experience something pleasant, sometimes what is pleasant for you may not give me the same emotion. What is exciting for me might not excite you. But each one of us have something that is pleasant, a sight which is so empowering and enlightening, and it just enthuses you. Every time we experience that, can we think of Swami? Then we will be able to eventually graduate to that level were both pleasant and unpleasant reminders of him. When there is something that is sad, when there is something that is happy, both will remind us of Swami's presence. So this is the path that Krishna is speaking about here. I think we'll stop here at this point because I'm completely running out of time. I actually wanted to play for you or speak about a certain poem which is associated with Swami, which conveys this idea that first you look at all the pleasant things and the happy things and learn this habit of having yourself reminded of God when these experiences are experienced. And then eventually you go beyond that, but I think we're completely out of time. I don't think I'll be able to do that. But dear listeners, thank you for tuning in. As I said in the beginning, this is not a live show. This has been recorded and for reasons I explained. Hopefully next week too, I will be able to give you a fresh episode of the Gita series and we can continue in this pilgrimage. Till then, keep safe. Take care of yourself. I'll meet you all again next week, Thursday, 7:30 p.m. on another show, on another episode, on another leg of this journey in the Gita series, A Triumph Pilgrimage. Thank you. I most humbly offer this at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Jai Sai Ram.